conformity aspect of it. And at first, people panicked, but then they realized you guys really are doing this election integrity and want to figure out what we actually do. And that's not a bad thing at all. I'm glad I will run my mouth all day about that.
Thank you so much for that. We've actually had a couple of registrars that said we will not meet with you.
Yeah, so yeah, I've seen that as well. And I think those may have been early on before it was realized that, this is legitimate.
Well, we'll circle back with those then. Hopefully, maybe they've changed their mind.
And maybe some of them are stubborn. We're an eclectic group, that's for sure. For sure. But yeah, y'all jump right
in. So you got the top all filled out there, everything?
Yes.
All the names and everything? Okay.
Well, if you would give me your name, sir.
Tracy Howard, TRACY HOWARD.
TRACY.
Mm-hmm.
And just Howard?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Got it.
Alrighty. And I am, for accuracy, I'm recording this, okay? Alrighty. So the time and date of the call.
We're at 10:35.
Of the initial call when I contacted you.
Yeah. Well, right now it's 10:35.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you are meeting with us, so C is yes. C is no, excuse me.
Yes.
Is no. You are meeting with us. All right. So I really appreciate your time.
Oh, sure.
I know there's a lot going on right now. So question number one, what is your biggest concern about the upcoming election?
My biggest concern is the disinformation, the misinformation, and the malinformation that's out there and available to everybody. Probably since 2008, people think they know how elections work when they truly do not have the first clue. So that's really my concern, is the disinformation that's out there about what really goes on.
Okay.
That truly is.
Mm-hmm. So how long have you been in this office?
Since 1992.
Oh, okay.
I'm approaching 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give me a couple examples of what they don't know, from your perspective, what you think people don't know?
Oh, sure. That the voting machines are hackable and all that stuff. That there are servers overseas, and that's all nonsense. That anybody other than an sworn election official actually deals with any of this stuff. You know, things of that nature. People don't understand the way the absentee early voting process works, and it's just difficult to make them understand the checks and balances that we actually have in place to make sure that it's one person, one vote, and nobody's fiddling with things, you know. So that's what I'm thinking.
Okay, so that would be actually the follow-up to number two. Any major concerns?
Mm-hmm.
Have anything else to add to that?
Not really. I've been doing this long enough. We've got a good electoral board, good group of officers of election. I don't have any major concerns about this upcoming election other than just the mud that's going to be slung. You know, we're already seeing it, and it's going to be a vitriolic election, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
But, you know, what are you going to do? I'll try to stay out of that nonsense.
Number three, do you feel like you have the resources, equipment, personnel, and training needed to run an effective election in November?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Can I do a follow-up on that one?
Oh, sure.
Do you think that there's sufficient poll watchers from the parties that will be here to observe?
Oh, certainly. Most certainly there are going to be sufficient poll watchers. As far as our cap, you know, our central absentee precinct and things like that, that's like watching paint dry. But we've always had observers there from both political parties. At the polling places, that's never been an issue. The issue has been too many observers at, you know, on occasion, you know, where it interferes with the officers and things like that. But I'm sure they have plenty of folks willing to watch.
Mm. right, so since you answered that, yes, you have, you feel like you have all the needed resources. Number five, the county election board is supposed to consist of two Democrats and a Republican under a Democrat governor. But in some areas, boards have trouble finding willing Republicans and have appointed an independent instead or another Democrat. What is the situation in this county?
We have two Democrats and a Republican serving currently.
Number six, what about precinct staff? Are you able to have equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans?
As much as possible, we do try to balance those out. We do have several independents, but our main focus is good civic-minded people who know what they're doing. A lot of our polling place teams have been together for some time, and we try to keep those folks in place. Simply because they're trained, they know what they're doing. And frankly, party affiliation is bottom of the list for me. It really is. We need good, trained, civic-minded people.
Okay. Number seven. Is the County Board of Elections engaged in your year... Is the County Board of Elections engaged in your work year-round or mostly near elections?
It's basically year-round, more so during election time.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, here the past 3 years, we've had an election every 3 months, so they're always in here. But yeah,
mm-hmm.
they're involved all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. All righty, now we're going to move on to questions on the voter roll.
Mm-hmm.
Number eight, when was the last time the voter file in your county was scrubbed or cleaned?
July 27th of this year. We actually did the statewide, what they used to refer to as the purge, but it's the list maintenance. The list is still on the bulletin board if you're interested. So we did that at the end of July, and that's an ongoing thing.
Mm-hmm.
I have a follow-up to that.
Sure.
How many were purged from the list?
It's better than 400. Mostly, you know, you're in a university town, so mostly college kids. It's going here, coming in, going out, you know, we turn over 2,500 individuals per year here in the city of Rapid. So.
Primarily because of the college?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 2,500 freshmen coming in, 2,500 seniors and attrition going out, and it's a continuous turnover.
Can I do a question?
Sure.
How do you do that? How do you know who to take off? What tells you to take off? Whether somebody's moved
that's based... Well, of course, decedents, felons, anyone who has moved under the National Chain of Address program. The state runs a program through the ERIC, which is the national consortium. Most of the states are members of that. We utilize the National Chain of Address, so if someone's moved out of state, we know that. And that's what these are now, are voter confirmations that they have either moved or moved out of state, you know, things like that. So we have done a good job here in the last decade utilizing technology to be able to maintain those voter rolls. So the Department of Elections has a slide that shows all of their input from everybody from the Social Security Administration, Department of Vital Statistics, state police, correctional facilities, everywhere that go into the VERIS system in order for us to maintain those folks. And if they don't belong there, we get them off.
You mentioned correctional systems.
Mm-hmm.
So it's my understanding that under the new law, felons can vote. Is this correct?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
There will have to be a constitutional amendment.
Okay.
For that.
Right.
Right now, the governor is still the only person who can grant that clemency to a former felon. Heaven's sakes, all governors since George Allen have expedited that process. And it's not automatic by any means, but it's easier for those folks at this point. But it's still granted on an individual case-by-case basis.
So it's not, again, my understanding, please correct me. My understanding is that there is a law that's coming that all felons will be allowed to vote.
If it would have to be a constitutional amendment.
Right, I heard you say that.
And
okay.
And That is determined by a voter referendum. Of course, it has to pass two functions of General Assembly with the General Assembly election intervening. So the earliest that could come onto the ballot will be 2022. They're always in even years. Mm-hmm. And then it would depend on the voters passing that referendum.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Number nine, I had to figure
eight
out where
eight.
We were.
We're on 8A.
Eight.
Or 9A. Oh, I'm sorry. There's
yeah.
an A there.
Right, there's an A and a B. 9A,
mm-hmm.
does the health department, coroner, or Bureau of Vital Statistics
those folks.
Send a list of deceased people to your office every month so they can be removed from the voter roll?
Not directly to our office, but like I was telling you before, it does go through the VERIS system and it comes into our system directly to our desktop. List of decedents, list of felons, list of mental incapacities. Things that nature.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it does. It gets to the state who disseminates it to the localities, not directly to our offices.
Mm-hmm. And they're pretty timely in what they do?
Yeah, they're real timely.
Mm-hmm.
They really are.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that kind of was the B question. How often do they send a list?
Generally, they will get a list of decedents once a month, once every few weeks. Felon list, that's populated a little more often because it comes from Department of Corrections and the courts, things of that nature. The mentally incapacitated, we get those on a monthly basis, and that does come directly from the circuit courts.
Okay. Okay. All righty, number 10. When was the last time the clerk of courts submitted a list of individuals who declined to serve on jury duty on the basis of being a non-citizen?
I've never seen that happen.
Okay.
I don't know that my wife is the clerk of court here. I don't know that she's ever had somebody who's claimed to be a non-citizen to get out of jury duty.
Okay, okay. So she would be the one to really ask that question, answer that question. If we wanted to collect that information, she would be the one.
I don't know that she would know. Yeah, the clerk of court's office down the hall here.
Okay.
I know that there is a place on a jury questionnaire that says, I'm not a citizen, I can't serve on the jury. I'm saying I don't think it's ever happened here.
Okay.
Now, we've got a lot of students who don't want to serve on juries, but no non-citizens that I'm aware of.
But students come from all over the state or even out of state.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Alrighty. Number 11. When was the last time you had access to the National Change of Address List or any other change of address list?
Like I said, that's ongoing. That's what these are for. They come directly from the National Change of Address through the VERIS system, which actually and I can't think of the word they use now. It's just comparison list. When addresses change, then we get notification that a confirmation notice has been sent, and those individuals are allowed to let us know that they've changed, or they go on the inactive list. And under NVRA, they would come off after two federal elections. We utilize all aspects of registration, absentee voting, returned mail, that kind of thing, to put those folks on the confirmation list. So that is an ongoing aspect. It's not just something, look at the National Change of Address List today. No, it goes on constantly. It's a 365.
Number 12A, are you confident that the voter file is accurate and up to date?
As accurate and up to date as any. It's in a constant state of flux. It's completely fluid. Somebody moves in, somebody moves out, somebody passes away. It's an ongoing process.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You had mentioned about being mentally incapacitated. So hospitals, doctor's offices, family, how are you?
Only the courts may declare an individual mentally incapacitated. and that is through the circuit courts here in Virginia. So that's where we receive that information from. You know, the 1902 Constitution used to say idiots and lunatics couldn't register. Well, that was completely up to the registrar. Now we have processes in place where only a circuit court or a higher court may determine that that person is not eligible to vote.
Thank you for that clarification.
Sure.
Alrighty, I'm going to skip B.
Yep.
13. How many households in your locality have more than 7 individuals registered at the same address?
I have no earthly idea, no way to get that information. I know we have some, for instance, 801 East Main Street. That is Radford University, and Muse Hall is 985 East Main Street. There are 1,400 kids that live there at any given time. So I don't, what's, let me ask you something. What's the magic about the number 7? 6 people at the same address, okay? What were your thoughts behind the question?
Yeah, that was just determined by our executive director.
Gotcha.
Of election integrity. His name is Tim Meisberger.
Okay.
And he's been building elections in third world countries for 30 years.
Oh, is it with IFAS or something like that?
Yeah, he's worked for the UN, he's worked for USAID, building elections around the world.
Sure.
And that these questions, he wrote these questions.
Okay.
So,
okay. Well, in a college town, yeah, we're going to have it.
So let me dovetail on that one a little bit. So when we're using walking for candidate softwares like I360, for example,
gotcha,
or Campaign Sidekick, I personally have seen addresses where there are multiple people at that address. So would you not have access to the voter rolls to be able to determine an address that has multiple voters at it?
Well, yeah, sure. The thing is, though, that may not be an unusual instance wherein someone has actually moved away from that address, have never re-registered somewhere. They were registered here previously. A new family moves in, re-registers that address. Nothing illegal about that. It's just a matter of those folks have not, or their registration has not caught up to them yet. I can't think of an instance at this point where we have something like that situation, because most of our residences, of course, are single family homes as you come this way away from the university. So, you know, it's one of those questions that is a little bit loaded in that there may not be anything other than just oversights involved in that. Because they're registered there doesn't mean they're voting there. Now, we can tell, I don't know of a report that I could run to say, okay, this address, who lives here and how many people live there and what are their situations. I'm not aware that we can actually do that at this point.
The concern is that there are organizations that are mailing absentee ballot applications and they're using the voter rolls. So if there's only 2 people living at an address and there's 5 that are registered there,
mm-hmm,
then you have 7 absentee ballots being applications being
right,
mailed to that address. Then the applications no longer at this address go back to the organization that's mailing these applications. And now they know that they have a registered voter at that address,
right,
with an absentee ballot in their hand,
mm-hmm,
that they can request.
Yeah.
That's the concern.
Well, I understand concerned with something like that. The thing about that is, if those 5, for instance, that you're talking about are returned to us, that's 5 felony instances, you know?
Well,
so,
yes, they would be 5 felonies.
Right.
Correct.
Yeah, so, you know, it's, I do understand the concern. I don't know how you combat that with the current laws as they are right now, because just a piece of return mail does not allow us currently to take that voter off the rolls. That puts them in inactive status.
The return mail would not come back to,
well,
you,
right,
going back
to
the organizations that are sending,
sure,
these out.
Well, and that's an issue with some of these third-party organizations,
yes,
out there, in that, well, first of all, they don't check their mailing list. We've gotten tons of absentee applications that had been brought in by kin folks saying, these people have been dead for 20 years. And to us, that's just junk mail. And we have been trying to work with the Virginia General Assembly for several years to get them to put some sort of limitations on the stuff that these folks can send out, whether it's the absentee list or voter registration applications. And those are going out at this time too. And we know that the voter registration list are not the voter registration list, but the mailing lists that these folks use are very outdated.
Well,
very old.
Virginia for America First organization understanding that they are getting these lists directly from the voter rolls. They're buying the list that
only
comes
for
out
the
of the
absentees. Only for the absentees. What these other folks are doing are sending voter registrations to people who are not registered currently.
Yes.
Or they think are not registered.
Right, there's
currently.
There's two different mailings.
Well, there's multiple.
Well, so the one that we predominantly are concerned with, not so much the registration.
Well, the mail ballot.
It's the mail and ballot application.
Yeah. One nice thing about being a very small locality like us is we know when properties change hands, when people move, you know, things like that. Not 100%, but I think we're a little more in tune to that than maybe, a humongous locality where you really can't keep track of that. But our hands are tied under the National Voter Registration Act on that stuff. We can't remove someone just because of return mail or the national change of address. A notice has to go to them. And that place, that's been
so this,
placed
you're talking about this
1993.
This is a legislative fix that needs to be done in the state?
It's in national.
But I know he's talking about the national, but the state does supersede the national.
See, that's it. The national supersedes the state. And we are tied under NVRA.
Right.
At this point. And that's been a problem that we have yelled about since 1993. About not being able to maintain addresses when we get that yellow label back. You know, this person has gone to X state. Well, NVRA says you put them on a confirmation list, they get a confirmation, and if they don't vote within 4 years, two federal cycles, then they come off. So it wasn't right then, and it's certainly not right now. That's where we are.
Thank you, Tracy.
Sure. Did any of that make sense? I feel like around
that
made perfect
no,
sense.
No, it actually it makes perfect sense.
Okay.
I understand it completely. You guys good with that? You got it?
Yeah.
You got a look on your face.
Yeah, stop me if I'm
wrong. I have a look on my face too, but that's fine. Y'all go ahead.
It's just unfortunate that it's a federal law. It's kind of tying your hands from something that you feel like, you know, you're almost like compelled.
Oh, I agree.
You should fix it.
Yeah.
And you can't.
A lot of times the localities have the ability to make those changes, but not the authority to make those changes.
That's interesting. I wonder how that works with the constitutionality of the state legislatures administering elections.
Yeah.
That was our question in 1996 when Virginia passed NVRA. Remember, like it was yesterday, it was March 1st, 1996.
Virginia
a sea change.
So it was a federal law in 93.
Right.
And then Virginia.
Virginia actually passed that in 1996, and it was done as emergency legislation.
Wow.
And it's still on the books in Virginia?
Yeah. That's right.
Hence why the problem we've got.
Yeah, that's right.
And if there was ability to fix it, we would do that. You would be
in
support of doing it.
I would be very
that.
In favor of fixing that,
right.
Because with the electronic means that are here now that were not available in 1996, it's gone beyond just the paper registration application that they had envisioned back in the early 90s. You know, so that's one of the things that would really help clean up. If we could clean up NVRA to fit today's methods, you know.
What's available today.
Yeah, that's right.
You guys have, is there like a registrar's association
yes.
or anything like that?
Mm-hmm.
You guys lobby?
Yeah. Yes, we do lobby General Assembly. Most recently for, you know, money, but basically any sort of resources for our offices, because all elections are paid for locally. And the state has basically washed their hands of that stuff.
What's the
I mean, even down to the printing of stuff. They used to send us elections in a box. Now we're responsible for printing envelopes, taking care of postage.
What's the name of that association?
It's the Voter Registrars Association of Virginia. I've been president of that organization twice. And it's basically, when we lobby the General Assembly, it is for technical issues within our offices, how things work, whether this could work. Sometimes they listen to us, sometimes they don't. And it depends on ideology. For the past about 8 years, neither party's listened to us. they want done what they want done, you know. So
it's your problem. They just say it's your problem.
Well, that's exactly it. They pass a law that says this will be done, and then they say, okay, now it's your baby to figure out how to do it. For instance, this year a law was just passed to split the difference between the absentee vote and the early vote, the absentee being mailed in ballots. So now we have to suddenly come up with a way to disseminate, okay, the early vote was this result, and then the mailed in absentee application or vote was this result. So what they've essentially done is made us buy another tabulator so we could keep those two results, sets of results. The best big idea was Senator Suderline back in Roanoke, who wanted us to keep those results separate on a by-precinct basis. So each precinct in any given locality would be separated out by their mail votes, by their absentee votes, and then the precinct results would be separate from the rest of the precinct votes. Where in a central absentee precinct, the entire county or city is just lumped into one set of results. You know, it's those kind of things that they think, oh, that'd be a good idea to have that, without thinking of the process of how you actually do that. So, you know, and it all costs money, and it costs the localities money. P&E, they don't care. They're an unfunded, mandated committee.
So I would imagine you've been doing this since 92.
Yes.
And you were the president of that association twice. Are you pretty influential in the association, or?
Not as much as I used to be. I've been kind of slowing down, about retiring.
Have they ever talked about going to the press with any of these concerns?
We attempt not to do that. We attempt not to do that because we are a political football.
Yeah.
When parties change at the General Assembly, we don't want anybody to say, oh, we remember you guys, and you guys didn't like something we tried to do. Because, simply, they make our life miserable enough without being angry with us, you know?
Yeah.
So, no, very rarely will we go to the press with an issue. Now, there are electoral board members out there that, who have gone independently, but as a whole, no. We're there for the betterment of the voters, not, you know, to pontificate on policy of any kind. We do as we're told.
All righty, so we're going on to 14, if everybody is clear with the number 13. Okay, 13 plus, plus, plus.
Thank you for the answers, too. Thank you very much.
Oh,
yeah,
sure.
Maybe it's good information.
Just stop me if I get the rambling.
All right, number 14. During registration, how do you verify that voters are citizens?
Well, voter, first of all, they check the box that says they're a citizen, but they're also signing a statement under penalty of perjury. When registrations come in through DMV, they're double-checked through the DMV. Of course, any DMV transaction, a lot of those require birth certificates in order to get their driver's license, things of that nature. So that's what we rely on. That's another National Voter Registration Act requirement. The national form that was first put out in 1996 doesn't even ask if an individual is a citizen, but it says it within the oath of the applicant. So there's another thing that really ties the states who are beholden to NVRA, that kind of ties your hands on those. And I don't know if you guys have seen the national form or not. I don't know if I've got any of the old ones left, but I'd be glad to let you take a look at those.
Okay.
If I can find some, they're back in my back room somewhere.
Alrighty, we'll blow the dust off them.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So it's basically an honor system then?
You know, basically it is. It basically is. Well, other than the DMV stuff.
But you know. Didn't they just pass legislation in Virginia to allow undocumented immigrants to get driver's licenses?
Then they become documented.
Right.
So.
And when they're applying for a driver's license, there is a box that pops up that says, would you like to register to vote? But it does not ask if you're a citizen, and you tap yes or no. So.
Well, that's a DMV internal thing.
Which
when
then
I was involved with that, and we, you think election bureaucracy is crazy? Go to the DMV.
We all go to the DMV.
Oh,
we all know
gosh.
This. We all know everybody in the Commonwealth knows that's a problem.
I'm talking about the state level DMV
right.
folks. I
right.
mean, it's crazy. And they do as they're told to, but then they are more beholden to political interests than perhaps we are. But, you know.
So, but you guys are relying on that. On the DMV to have verified
very
citizenship.
Basically, particularly with the online registrations. With the online registration forms, there are theoretically checks in place that have utilized, you know, which ID and residence proof that these folks have utilized, but it's also circular in that they can utilize a voter registration card for one of the secondary proofs of residence. You know, so yeah, there are some issues there. I can't even sugarcoat that. There are some issues.
Has this been something that the association has brought up?
Oh, many times.
Many times.
Many times. But again, we're kind of beholden to the NVRA as far as the way those questions are asked. But the states could do something about that should they choose. But, you know, even heaven's sakes, the past 3 years, there's been a sea change in elections because the General Assembly changed parties. But even prior to that, the past 20 years, there was really no legitimate push from the R's in the General Assembly to make sure that these folks are truly residents of their locality and their precinct. And, you know, like I said, we do as we're told.
We really appreciate all of
oh,
this.
Sure.
Thank you so much.
I'm giving you more than you want, I'm sure.
Well, moving on, as it says here on the page.
Yes, she does.
I see that. It does.
Concerns were raised across the country about the accuracy and integrity of voting machines in the 2020 elections. So 15, there are three types of voting machines used in Virginia. Can you tell us which machines you use?
We have the Dominion ICE.
Dominion ICE, and number 16, who calibrates the voting machines, and can you please explain the process?
Sure. They are done by Atlantic Election Services. They are a Virginia company that's been here. They've been our voting custodian for at least 45 years. What they do is they will come, we'll let the parties know. They utilize, of course, everything's computerized now, but these are paper ballot tabulators, and the paper ballots are just fed through and scanned. They just count. What they do is give us a call. They will bring the machines down here. It's a public meeting of the electoral board. the voting machine custodian will have the ballots. They're actually on flash drives. They're programmed on a computer that is also never connected to the internet. So those flash drives go into each machine. At that point, we'll use a test deck of actual ballots that are marked in various ways. Overvotes, undervotes, write-in votes, ambiguous marks, and run those through each tabulator to ensure the accuracy of those tabulators. Then they're set up, they're locked down until election day. On election day, they're actually broadcast at the polling places. Did that answer your questions?
Sure did.
That was the process, yes.
Thank you.
17, do you invite party representatives to witness this calibration?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you do. Okay. All right. Moving on to the third page here, number 18. Are your voting machines ever connected to the internet?
Never, ever. They have no means of being connected to the internet. And that's what people don't understand. They're dumb in the fact that they have no connectability at all.
They don't have connectability. Okay. So if they are not connected to the internet, how and when are they updated?
Well, just like the process I just explained, they are, well, updated or logic and accuracy testing. Which are you asking?
Well, about? The question is asking how and when are they updated?
So far, ours have been updated one time. That was prior to the May elections of 2016. And those were updated in the same way in which they are programmed, in that they are just downloaded into the firmware by the custodians, who was at that time Atlantic Election Services. So that was done prior to the May of 16 city council elections, and it was because the certifications from EAC and the state had improved security.
Okay. Now you had said, was I asking you if they were updated or there was a second word you were using?
They're LNA tested, logic and accuracy, and that's where we bring the machines out, the party observers are here, we set up for each election.
Okay.
And that's done before each election?
That's done prior to each election. Mm-hmm. We'll let you know that all the machines in Virginia are slated for firmware updates within the next year, where the EAC and the certifications have gotten even more strict. All the machines are updated for an update security firmware update here very soon. The problem with that is that's all on the localities. We have to pay for all that as well.
So when you say security firmware, what does that entail?
It is just the firmware that's within the machine that actually does the tabulations. Part of it is they actually take a photo. There are PDF photos of every single ballot that's placed through the machine. And of course we keep those photos for all presidential, all federal elections actually. We keep those ballot images, they're called. And I think they're upgrading the ballot imaging portion of that.
But security, though, because I'm wondering if it's a dumb machine, right?
Yeah, my understanding.
Yeah, if it's a dumb machine, then why would it need to have anything other than physical security? Does that make sense?
Well, that's what we've been yelling for years. Because everybody, well, since we had in 2002 the Help America Vote Act made us go get rid of our old lever machines, made us go to touch screens, and people start, oh, they're hackable. Well, sure, any computer can be hacked, but you have to physically get to the things, know what you're doing, take them apart, and do it all in the confines of the elections office. You know, a steel box can be broken into if you have enough time and resources to do it. So none of these things are unhackable. But the physical security added with the security of the firmware and stuff like that, that's what makes them
Do you understand what I'm asking, Josh?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
If it's a dumb machine, what does it need a security update for?
What does it need information security for if it's a dumb machine?
Correct.
What I know about IT, you can put in your shirt pocket. I know the State Board of Elections has required security or firmware updates. Now, maybe security is the wrong word. That's my word. But we're all getting firmware updates.
And you said the last one was May, prior to the May election of 2016.
Well, we didn't actually begin utilizing the ICE machines. We started in 2013, and that was our absentee precinct machine. That was the one that got updated because by May of 2016, we had used the Dominion machines, ordered those because we had to get rid of the old touch screens. We were actually 2 years ahead of that because the state decertified all touch screens in 2017. So that was the timeline of that. And those machines were just brought in. They were updated at that time. And then the May general election was placed on those, and that was the city council school board race.
So everything across the state now is going to be a paper ballot that's going to be scanned?
That's right. It has been since 2017.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you had said that this was, you here in this Radford City, you used the Dominion.
Right.
But this firmware, no matter, no matter what brand they use across the state, there's
right.
every one of them is going to
everyone's getting updated because of the new EAC requirements. And that, now I may be foggy on some of those details, but I do know that it's due to the new EAC requirements. And the state actually in 2017 built in a process where each voting machine must be recertified every 4 years. So that's where we are in the cycle.
From prior to a presidential election?
Not necessarily.
Okay. Within that 4 year window?
Within that 4 year window.
Your machine, then it would be May 2020, for example, if it was May 16 prior to that.
Yeah, well, we didn't do any updates at that time because they didn't want to do any firmware updates when we knew that this election was going to be so huge. We didn't want to risk any sort of, you know, any kind of problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because every time you update your computer, what happens? You got something that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So we have not updated since we got those machines early on. But now the firmware is required to be updated.
So that you said the EAC requirements, what does EAC stand for?
The Election Assistance Commission. It's part of the FEC in D.C. And they do the voting machine certification best practices, really. They're not a law-making or policy-making body, but most of the states follow the EAC's guidelines because they're put together by the various secretaries of states and each state's representative to the EAC.
Is there policy in Virginia to meet the EAC requirements?
Yes, and that's what the update to policy in 2017 was, to meet those new best practices and EAC requirements. At that time, we were still using the old touchscreen machines,
yeah.
And of course, they were coming to the end of the life cycle anyway. So that's when we went to the Dominion ICE because we kept the same vendor that we were utilizing. That is Atlantic Election Services.
So it's been policy in the state since 2017 to follow the EAC requirements.
I think it was probably policy prior to that.
They updated them.
That's when I'm thinking.
They did the firmware update in 2016, correct?
At least once.
Okay.
And that was early on up in the year. And the only reason I remember that is because our machines looked brand new at that time.
And then the best practices, which are policy, is to have that firmware updated every 4 years, correct?
You know, I don't want to put words in their mouth. I would have to look. I could probably find the certification requirements that the state board passed several years back. And that was in 17 because I was president at the time, and that's when we decertified all the touchscreens.
Okay.
So I could probably find that document pretty quickly. But, you know, it's like 100 pages long, a lot of technicalities and stuff.
Yeah,
like
I'm
that.
Just, you understand what I'm saying. And it's, I'm just wondering if it was policy to do it every 4 years, it was done in 2016 here. And then it wasn't done because of how big the election was.
Now, let me see.
What's
I feel like I've taken us down a rabbit hole that maybe I shouldn't have.
Okay, no worries.
See, because it also helps if we can understand your challenges, if we can, you know, we can bring awareness to.
Yeah.
Challenges for you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I want to
double down on what he just said.
Okay.
You have mentioned that you cannot be political.
Right.
Well, there are organizations like us. If we know that there are challenges, we can be. We can help sway legislation that can help to work things out.
Well,
in a positive, because what works for you is better for all citizens.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
The thing about it is so much of it is looked at in a snapshot type of light where there is, you can't do that. It's an entire timeline, a long running process, and it's a year round type of process. Mm-hmm. You know, so everybody thinks of elections as the 3 minutes they're in the polling place. Hell, it ain't magic. It takes us 100 days to get this stuff put together. Get everything in, there's a lot of stuff in the background there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And even the General Assembly, they fail to realize that because they go in there and they don't have any problems on election day, it's never thought of again. It's when they have an issue on election day, then that gets addressed immediately. You know, so.
Pretty sure if every incumbent got voted out, they would have an issue right away.
That would be an issue.
Thus the need for term limits. But yeah, let's leave that alone.
Okay.
We won't go down that. And what I'm looking for is those requirements for the voting machine.
Is there another moving on paragraph here?
Yeah, many changes. Yeah, let's see.
I'm just wondering, kind of just segueing on what we just said, if we don't need to try to create a relationship with that Registrar's Association, you know?
Oh, I would think so.
Like a listening ear, saying like, hey, like seriously, tell us what your top five challenges are.
I think any organization that's interested in election integrity should have a relationship with that Registrar Association.
Then,
absolutely.
Then you need to get a hold of VRAV and VBA, the Electoral Board Association, as well. And
we got those written down.
Are independent associations,
okay.
But we work very closely together in order to affect not ideological changes. Now, don't get me wrong, they're not ideological, it's technical. It's
process
how
efficiency.
It's process efficiency. It's how this would work better than that. As a matter of fact, we go over not to weigh in on ideological stuff. I personally, when early voting was passed in Virginia, we tried our best to stay out of that. But every time I was in the General Assembly building, one of the delegates grabbed me by the arm, come here, I need to talk to you about this. And the thing about the early voting that most people don't understand is it is the safest means of voting because you've got that individual, their ID, the state system, right there in front of the registrar. And that was what our Republican members were trying to get their head wrapped around, that it really is the safest means of voting.
Early in-person voting is phenomenal.
Our voters love it.
Yeah,
they absolutely love it. And the great thing about it is you get to see all these folks that you haven't seen since the last election, catch up with the kids, you know, stuff like that. So it builds a lot of community to do that because these same folks utilize that absentee and early voting process, or will be, I'm sure, because as our absentee was previously, it was always the same elderly shut-in people.
Yeah.
And that is what is the best part of my job, is being able to help those folks who normally couldn't get out or cast their vote, something like that, especially older folks.
Yeah.
You know, that's always been the best part of my job.
I think there's a bad stigma on early voting that shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going to move on.
Okay.
Many changes in election procedures were introduced in response to the COVID pandemic, and some people have argued that these changes weakened the integrity of the election process. Number 19, as an election professional, do you think the changes made in the election process in Virginia in response to COVID have weakened election integrity, strengthened election integrity, or made no change in election integrity?
I don't think it made a lot of change toward election integrity at all. The reason I say that is not the integrity of the election and the way it was run within the office. What it did, it confused voters. It really confused voters because the same set of rules weren't in place for three different elections in 2020. The March primary, the May elections, and the June primaries all operated under different sets of rules. And it confused voters. It got voters' ballots not counted because what they read in the paper was one thing and what they did was quite different. Those changes, it didn't affect the integrity of the election because our rules were still in place, but it really affected the confusion of voters.
The trust level. Of the voters.
That was the beginning of the end, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
That really was the beginning of the end because they continued to make those changes through the pandemic,
mm-hmm.
as to whether this was required, whether that was required, whether in-person, mail was good, mail was bad, you know, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
And overarching things like the lack of efficiency on the part of the Postal Service.
Mm-hmm.
Really lent itself to that. I mean, we had ballots that we mailed on opening day, and they didn't get to where they were going across town for 5, 6, 7 days.
Right in this small city.
Right across town. Yeah. We're 9 square miles. They go to Greensboro. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, the same way it does in Lynchburg.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, down further southwest, they go to Kingsport, Tennessee. So those regional centers, even though we have the live barcodes and we can somewhat track that mail, the barcode's not read until it gets to Greensboro. So it's always a day difference, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that did not help the process at all. That really didn't. But as far as the integrity, I think it was just as upfront and...
Yeah, to clarify, everything was still in place.
Everything was
it's
still in place.
It's just that the laws were a moving target.
Right, yeah. They were a moving target. Yeah. And our instructions were moving targets. Heaven's sakes, we were printing new instructions every 3 months, literally.
Mm-hmm.
And then there would be a change or a difference based on what this particular special session of the General Assembly happened to do.
Okay.
You know, so I wish they'd leave us alone.
But were some of those changes not directly a result of an executive order, not through the legislature?
Not that I recall.
Emergency executive order, particularly.
Didn't they drop
Which one are you referring to?
Well,
because I know the witness requirement, that was done under special session. It had to be. And the witness, that's worthless anyway. We never read the signature, never know who signed it. You know, there's no information with the witness signature to tell you who that person is anyhow. It's been like that ever since in office, and as far as I know, no one has ever been prosecuted for fraudulently witnessing one of these things.
Yes, thank you.
20A, did you receive any funding or in-kind contributions for training, staff, voter education, or equipment, or any other purpose from outside the state of Virginia?
We receive CARES Act funding, but anything, and I know you're talking about Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook money and stuff like that. No, we won't take it. I won't even apply for those kind of grants because that masks the true cost of elections from the people who do your budgets.
Yeah, it was the Center for Tech and Civic Life, I think is what it was.
We didn't do that at all.
Yeah.
Didn't do that at all. I know that the department has worked with the Center for Tech and Civic Life for forms and things of that nature. But as far as money, no, we don't go outside for money.
You want to reflect the true cost of the election.
Well, absolutely. That's why I don't even use volunteers. Because volunteers, yeah, well, they can come in and they can help you stuff envelopes and stuff like that. But that's real work that should be handled by real professionals, and they should be paid accordingly. It masks the true cost of elections, and then your localities who have the burden of paying for the elections, then they wonder, well, why is this so expensive? Well, because it's really expensive. Mm-hmm. Heaven's sakes, just mailing postage costs for us is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, so it is what it is. But no, I don't take any outside.
Ever thought about being the Secretary of State?
Huh?
Ever thought about being the Secretary of State?
Wouldn't have it. I have been in this office long enough to know never to run for anything and never to hold higher office.
20B. So you refused contributions other than the CARES.
The CARES money, and that paid for the expansion of this office, the countertops you see, the writing surfaces and things like that. And that was done for the early voting because we knew that first early voting cycle was going to be a barn burner, and it was. So we were able to put together room here for folks to actually come in and vote ahead.
Okay.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
At this office, does the 40 feet begin at that threshold or the threshold on the other side of security?
It's the door, the outside door.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. 21. Effective July 1st, 2021, Senate Bill 1097 eliminated requirements for voters to have a witness signature on absentee ballots for any election during a declared state of emergency. The governor has now rescinded the state of emergency. How are you training your staff to ensure that there is a signature match for the upcoming elections?
I think you just answered that.
Yeah,
yes.
You know, that witness signature, it's got to be there. We just look for it. Of course, you all are very aware that there is a new law in place where we must cure a ballot that comes in mail that is missing some piece of information that would. But generally, we don't have that problem too much, but we just know to look for that witness signature.
Okay.
And we expect that to be repealed within the next couple of years because it generally doesn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Let me show you what I'm talking about. This is our, I don't have any live ballots here, but it's just signature of voter, signature of witness, and a date on this envelope. And that's what we're looking for is the full oath taken care of. Well, it's gone back and forth, like I said, several times here this past year about that witness signature. But even prior to that, when I first came into office in 1992, the envelopes were exactly the same, just a little different form. Voter signature, witness signature. And there was never anything that said who this witness is or what their relationship is with that voter. It's just a scribble. So it's never been helpful anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A false sense of security.
A false sense of security.
Mm-hmm. All righty. 22. There is a lot of concern in Virginia and across the country about the security and integrity of the ballot drop boxes. What are the chain of custody procedures for ballot drop boxes?
Well, I'm the only one with the key. We have one here, and it's right out front of this building. There are two cameras trained on it, and we've got the video feed right back here in the office. That drop box is only in use during that early voting time. Now, there are drop boxes now required at each of the precincts. We keep those where the officers can see them along with all the rest of our equipment. It's not something that we just willy-nilly put out on the street corner. As a matter of fact, I was approached by one of the parties this year to put a drop box on campus for Radford University this year, and I flat out refused because we could not come up with the security that was necessary and is required by the state board's policy. They have to have the video cameras trained upon.
Two questions.
Mm-hmm.
Will you tell us what party that was?
It was the D's.
And then the second thing is, you said there's two cameras trained on the box, which is just outside.
Mm-hmm.
The surveillance recordings, are they accessible to a third party? For example, we came in and said, we'd like to see the tapes between 8:10 and 8:25 because one of our outside watchers saw somebody come in and drop a stack of ballots.
In that case, you would have reported that to me.
Okay.
We would go back, take a look at it. If we saw something that was sketchy, I'd go next door to the Commonwealth Attorney. But as far as saying, oh, a third party, we'd like to look at your tapes, no. We would have to go through a particular chain in order to affect the type of prosecution that might be necessary. For instance, if somebody dropped a match in a thing,
right,
they're on tape, we can tell, and we would have the evidence there. The tapes are saved for, I think our system saves for 60 days. I mean, it's a considerable amount of time. And then we would go straight next door to my buddy Chris.
23. Was there any time during the last election cycle when your drop boxes did not have video monitoring?
Not at all. And we only have the one that's right out here.
24. Who is responsible for reviewing the video, and were party observers present during the review?
We've never had reason to review yet.
Okay.
We would review upon a complaint or upon an issue that we found.
And again, it would be reviewed by you, but not with other observers to review.
I would call the electoral board immediately, and of course the two parties there, I'm sure they would call their party chairs. The thing is, I would not go outside of the chain of custody
mm-hmm.
prior to that. Mm-hmm. That's one thing that I've learned is when you create a record, your record has to be straight, and there has to be a very straight line of that record. Otherwise, if you get too many people involved or outside groups involved, then things become muddled and your prosecutions go away.
All right. Now, to strengthen public confidence in the integrity of elections, we hope to expand our observation efforts and have a few questions about election pages, nonpartisan observers, and party observers. So 25, would you provide training and support or designate us to provide training and support for an election day page program as described in the 24.2-604?
Right, you're talking about the high school pages.
Yes.
And we don't utilize the high school pages. And the reason we don't, we've never really had a necessity to have that sort of, a runner or something like that, because they really can't do anything and kind of get in the way.
Mm.
We would rather have officers of election who are able to assist.
26, would you authorize nonpartisan election observers with the same rights as party representatives as described in 24.2-604.5A?
Not autonomously and not on my own. That would be something that I would work with the electoral board and let that decision be made by the overall board. I know that 604 says the registrar or the electoral board. I prefer to think of it as the electoral board and the registrar. These decisions can't be made on an individual basis just because it smells funny.
Mm-hmm. Okay. 27, would you authorize international nonpartisan observers from recognized election monitoring organizations?
You know, we've never been asked, but I know that there are other places closer to D.C. that have been asked to host these nonpartisan observers, and I don't see a reason not to do that. You know, if the State Department calls and says, hey, we've got these people from X country that would like to observe your election, oh, yeah, bring them on, I guess.
Well, we'll put that as a yes.
Qualified, yes.
Qualified, yes.
Qualified, yes. And if somebody calls me up and says, I'm with the Iranian embassy and I'd like to watch your elections, probably not. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm.
Right.
So it's something that you have to dig into. Mm-hmm. Like anything we're talking about here, there's never one straight yes or no answer to these things. It's something you have to look into the background of.
Sounds like a with proper clearance.
Yes,
I like qualified yes, though. I like that. That's right to the point.
Sure.
Yeah.
28. Have your local party chairs been notified that they are entitled to send observers to your office each day it is open and receiving in-person absentee ballots?
They are very aware of that, yes.
They are very aware of that.
Very aware of that. Okay. I don't think I notified them of that particular thing. I know both parties have notified them of those, and I've been asked about. Yeah, they're more than welcome to sit here and watch the paint dry if they'd like to. Otherwise, just don't get in the way of the voters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 29A, do you have a publication that you provide to your election officials regarding rights and responsibilities of observers?
Yeah, the Department of Elections, they have an observer's rights and responsibilities document, what can be done, what can't be done, the laws, you know, that go over that. So we utilize that document. It's part of what is.
Okay. And B.
Yeah, those are actually accessible right on the website. Those are downloadable.
Yeah.
The what ifs, the rights and responsibilities.
I think so.
And
yeah.
All
of that
too.
Stuff. Yeah, it's the Officer of Election Day Guide.
Correct. That's the other one.
And yeah, they're all there, and they're all very transparent about that stuff. And they've gotten made copies for all kinds of people of those things.
Yeah, that's one of the things I've noticed, that I'm traveling the Commonwealth teaching people mm-hmm. on poll observation, election
sure.
integrity, and I've noticed that if I don't actually hand them a physical document asking them to go to a website later, sometimes it's amazing how it's accessible, but unless it's handed.
You gotta know where to look, that's
isn't
right.
That something?
Yeah, you gotta know where to look.
And
the state's website. And I'm so sorry. It's so hard to find anything. Like, I was looking for those voting machine requirements. I know they were there. I can't put my hands on
it. Well, the website has changed just in the past couple of weeks. You used to be able to go straight to the website, and there was a tab or whatever, a link for election officers. It's not there anymore. And the only reason I'm able to find it,
really?
It used to be right up top. Now the reason I can find it because it's in my cache, where I actually have saved it on other documents. I'm sorry,
you're right.
Yeah, it's not there anymore.
Well,
and that's also where you
page.
Go to find the what ifs, the rights and responsibilities, and the election day officer manual.
Ever since the department has actually had a web page, it has never been static. It has always, gone through these iterations and changes and whatever the administration wants you to see, what they don't want you to see, and it's all administrations. I'm not blaming this on one side or another. Sometimes they're more transparent than others. Sometimes you have to go through all sorts of hoops just to find something.
Yes, sir.
And it's whatever's important to them at that time, I think. Yeah.
All right. 29B.
Okay.
If no, would you be willing to distribute? Well, there are, you do provide, so.
We do.
Yeah, so that's.
But as far as a publication from any other group, nuh-uh.
Yeah, okay.
Only official documentation because of point
forces. All right. Well, I want to thank you for completing this survey.
Oh, sure, you're welcome.
And
I'm sorry for chewing your ear today.
No, we deeply appreciate your time. We've covered a lot of territory. And is there anything else, Mr. Howard, that you can think of that you would like to mention at this time? Now's your opportunity.
The one thing that I think that needs to be said is the security of elections is greater today than at any time in my tenure. It genuinely is. It used to be we left the voting machines in each of the schools, just left them sitting there. There'd be milk and everything else splattered everywhere. Now everything geared towards security and has been since the mid-2000s. Now the cybersecurity, we're getting all sorts of information from the EISAC and the MSISACs at the federal level, watching for the security of all the systems, voter registration system, the poll book systems, the election systems, any sort of threat. And what I'm more secure today than it ever has been, literally, physically, and through IT. But please explain to folks that no, we don't have somebody from Venezuela who is getting these numbers on a server somewhere. That's one thing that has been so difficult to address because folks are so willing to believe it.
Now, and I'm not saying there is, but how do you know that?
Been working in elections for 30 years. Very familiar with the workings of these machines. Know exactly what's there. There's no internet connectivity. We cannot go to a server with results. They are input with our fingers right through the system, which is a secured statewide system. If, and there are so many multiple checks and balances in place, that's why if you see a change the day after elections for somebody's numbers, there's always a news story about what happened.
Yeah.
You know, it's very dependent upon the people locally, not some broad-flung federal group. It's not some state group. These are your friends and neighbors that are doing your elections. And literally, our officers of election, they live all over town here. Everybody knows these folks. Nobody's out to get you or prove that your guy won or prove your guy didn't win. They're there for the civic duty of it. And I believe that to be the case. I know it is all of Virginia. And, you know, so that's just my little soapbox.
So
we really do work hard to keep these things correct and right to reflect the genuine will of voters.
And I'm just trying to understand here the process. So somebody comes in and they vote on a paper ballot.
Right.
The ballot gets scanned through the machine, right? Then the paper ballots are retained.
They're kept, yes.
For how long?
At least 22 months.
22
that's,
months.
That's federal law is 22 months. We normally came for 2 years.
And is that all elections or just federal elections?
All elections.
Okay.
All elections.
Now, that machine then creates the PDF image of each ballot.
It does. It's on the machine and can be downloaded through the flash drives. What those flash drives are redundant memory.
Okay.
They're triple redundant memory in each of the machines. It was that way with the old touchscreen machines. It's that way with HART, with ES&S, with Dominion, any of the machines in use in Virginia today. It's those flash drives do not do anything except record what is given to it.
Results.
By the tabulator, and the tabulator, it just looks for the marks. Let me see if I can, I don't know if I've got one here or not, I don't have one. Each of the ballots, notice what looks like a barcode.
Yes, yeah, I'm familiar.
That's
like
just,
Scantron.
Yeah, Scantron sheet, and all that is a lined up, a column, a row, you know.
Yeah.
That only lines those up within the machine so it can get that image and record whether the target is filled in or not filled in.
So
that's really all that thing does.
Is there some sort of adjudication process if, like, let's say...
Oh, yeah, if something breaks.
Well, no, not if something breaks. Let's say I fill out a ballot and I decide I'm not going to vote for senator, and I leave it blank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an undervote.
Okay, what happens when the machine detects the undervote?
It records it as an undervote.
Okay.
It will count the other votes because they're all separate target areas. And the ballot image will be of the entire face of that ballot.
Or if somebody makes a stray mark or something like that, what happens then?
That's an ambiguous mark, and the machine will kick it back to the voter to give them a second chance.
Okay.
And we do that a lot in here with absentee and early voting, where particularly elderly people can't quite stay in the target area.
Yeah.
And the machine will kick it back, tell them ambiguous mark. All we do is fold over that ballot, write spoiled on the back, give them a brand new fresh ballot, and let them reinsert and retabulate.
So flat out, there shouldn't be any ballots with ambiguous marks because the machine won't accept it, basically.
Exactly, yeah. It will always kick those back. Now, it does give the voter the option to go ahead and cast that ballot. And generally, if the machine will read the correctly marked offices, but the ambiguous mark may be left as it is, and that's usually a no vote, it's an undervote. So the machine will also kick back over votes. You voted for two people in the same office, you know, something like that. But as far as an adjudication process, once those ballots go through the tabulator, that vote is cast. And that's where it stays.
So there's no like human adjudication process of the ballots after the fact?
Not unless there is a an audit or the court orders a hand recount.
Okay.
And then in that case. Often what we find, and this happens more often in our central absentee precinct, the ambiguous mark you're talking about.
Yep.
When the tabulator kicks back that ballot because of the ambiguous mark, then it is laid on top of the machine, and the officers, Republicans and Democrats, after everything is done, then they adjudicate those ballots.
Okay.
If it's done in the polling place, the voter's given a second chance, given another ballot. These, and the state just sent out requirements for hand-marked ballots this morning. So, you know, if you've got one that won't go through the machine, an overseas ballot, for instance, a Yokava that was mailed back on plain paper, those won't go through the machine. They have to be hand counted. So there are stringent standards as to how those are adjudicated by the officers. This office never gets to do that. That's done by the officers of election.
Okay.
And it's their full authority on election day.
No,
I keep going circular.